Well, warmer weather is here and the insects will soon follow. I'm Jill Nadeau. Thanks for spending some of your time with us on the Ideas Network. PJ Leish is back. He is the manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, and he'll talk about some insects that are making the news and, of course, take your bug-related questions. So give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@WPR.org. PJ, thanks for being with us.
Sure, it's good to be here today, Jill.
So I've been hearing all these rumors about this large spider that is apparently parachuting into our lives. What's the truth about this arachnid?
Sure. So I have seen a lot of news stories recently about a spider called the Joro spider. And it is relatively large, and so if you do see it, it'll catch your attention. I do want to point out first and foremost that it's not here in Wisconsin. At the moment, it is in the southeastern part of the country. It originally came from parts of East Asia, and we think probably in shipping containers and cargo containers, things like that. It got introduced, and so at the moment, it's known from places like Georgia, nearby parts of South Carolina, and I've seen some more recent reports from eastern parts of Tennessee and nearby parts of North Carolina. So at the moment, it's just this little pocket where it's established in the southeastern part of the U.S. It is getting a fair amount of attention down there because the spiders are large and conspicuous. They have a bright, distinctive black and yellow coloration. And with the leg span on the females, their legs can stretch out about 3 inches or so. The actual body length is about an inch, but with their legs out, they can be relatively large size.
And they're really pretty, aren't they?
You know, they are actually. And one thing I want to point out about these spiders is they belong to a group, a family of spiders we call the orb weavers. And we've all probably learned about these at one point or another, and they are perhaps best known for the children's book Charlotte's Web, that story where there's the spider that sits in the web and you know, creates words and things like that. That's a type of orb weaver spider, and so these spiders have somewhat similar habits. They're known for making webs and sitting in them. They're not very good at moving around. They can't walk very well. They're really adapted for sitting in those webs and waiting for prey to come to them.
And before we go any further, they're not going to hurt anybody, are they?
Right. And this is really true of pretty much almost all of our spiders out there. These are really harmless creatures. They do technically have venom. The thing is, their venom is, first of all, really going to be quite weak and mild. It probably, if they were to bite you in theory, it would be like a mild bee sting. But behaviorally, and this is true of many spiders, they really don't want to bite you. Maybe if you were to grab one barehanded and you were squeezing it or something, it may bite defensively, but their typical behavior is not to bite. They're not aggressive. So really, there's no harm to humans from these spiders at all.
And what about this parachuting thing? I mean, they spread in kind of an unusual way, don't they?
Well, yeah, and it turns out that a number of spiders can use kind of parachuting, or sometimes that you may hear the term ballooning, which is a way that spiders can move around using silken threads.
And also one more thing I heard about was the fairly large webs that they do weave.
Yeah, so I was seeing a lot of stories in the news last fall, actually around the time of Halloween, which is probably a fitting time for it. So again, these spiders do produce very large silken webs. And one thing that is interesting about them is sometimes this Joro spider will make webs that are fairly high up. We're talking 15 to maybe 30 feet off the ground. And so I have seen a number of pictures where they were making webs up amongst like telephone and electrical wires, whereas a lot of the spiders that we are familiar with here in the Midwest may make webs, but it might be from like our downspout on our gutter or something like that. And they're not going to be way up in trees or up in power lines for the most part. So this Joro spider, which again is only in the southeast U.S., can make some rather large, conspicuous webs.
Wonderful. It sounds so interesting. And they're probably not going to get up this way. It's kind of chilly for them, isn't it?
Well, it is, and that's a big question that I have been getting, and in surrounding states, we've been seeing that question asked. Well, we don't know for sure at this point. There's a possibility it may eventually make its way farther northward, but we just don't know for sure what the northern extent of its range will be. Just as a little bit of kind of background about this spider, there's a closely related species, which is also fairly large size, also black and yellowish, and it's been established in the southeastern U.S. for, you know, well over 150 years. And that spider species, which is called the golden silk spider, is really restricted to pretty much the Gulf Coast states and then on up towards the Carolinas. It doesn't make it up here to Wisconsin. So if that's a close relative, that may give us a better idea of what may be going on in terms of future spread. However, there was a recent study that came out that looked at maybe the cold tolerance of these spiders. And the scientists think that this Joro spider might be able to tolerate cold a little bit better. I still have some questions, though, after reading the study, because one of the things they did is they basically took these spiders and put them in a freezer for a very short period of time and then took them out and would see if they survived or not. And that really isn't a good representation of a cold Wisconsin winter up here. So my suspicion is that it may be just too cold for us up here in Wisconsin. It's possible they might be moved with movement of vehicles and human goods and things like that. But my suspicion at the moment is that they may have a hard time surviving in a place like Wisconsin just due to our cold temperatures during the winter months.
Okay. Well, thank you for all the facts, PJ. We appreciate that. And also making the news is a new name for a moth that we've had in the state for a while. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so this is relatively new out there in the news. Just in the last month or so, there is an insect which we are now calling the spongy moth. And this is an insect that we are all familiar with. We have certainly heard of it. It was formerly known as the gypsy moth. However, the term gypsy, it was a derogatory term referring to the Romani people. And so there is the Entomological Society of America, which actually has a committee that looks at and reviews and approves common names. And so that group looked at the name of this insect and has renamed it the spongy moth for good reason. And that is that the egg masses of these insects are very spongy in appearance and texture. And so, again, this is the insect which was formerly known as the gypsy moth. Now we're calling it the spongy moth, though. And so it's relevant now because of, that name change, but also it has been trending upwards in the state over the last couple of years. And you can actually go out today in your own yard or in your neighborhood and look for those spongy egg masses. They're about an inch to maybe 2 inches long, usually a dark beige color. And they do have a very spongy texture if you touch them, and also kind of a velvety texture as well. And each of those egg masses can contain anywhere from about 500 to maybe 1,000 eggs. We have seen them trending upwards the last 2 years. They seem to do really well if we have dry springs. And so that makes me a little bit nervous that there's a lot of egg masses out there which could be hatching, and we could see a lot of caterpillars in April and May causing damage to landscape trees and forest trees such as oaks and other species.
So what should we do if we find these little spongy masses?
Well, and that's something you could do today. You could go out as soon as the show is done, look for these egg masses, and one very simple thing is if those egg masses are in an accessible spot, is you could take something like a putty knife or paint scraper and actually physically scrape them off. Sometimes they are going to be on the trunk of trees or branches. But again, if they're within reach and you can get them, scraping them off is a good option. Sometimes they're not going to be on trees, though. They could be on the side of a garden shed, for example, the underside of a pile of boards or something like that. And this is one of the reasons why this insect can be such a bad invasive species, because if you have some of these egg masses on the underside of a camper or a trailer and you drive out west to go camping, to Yellowstone or something like that, you could easily move not just one of these insects, but a whole colony of hundreds or thousands of them. So it is a big concern for us. So scraping off those egg masses is a pretty simple thing you can do today before they hatch. They're going to hatch probably sometime in about mid to late April. It depends on how warm of a spring we have.
Okay. And once we scrape them off, how should we dispose of them?
Well, one thing I would do, I would probably scrape them off into like a container of soapy water, or you could simply scrape them into a container, and then you could bag them and discard them that way. Put them in the trash, for example, would be a very simple thing. You wouldn't want to scrape them off and just leave them at the base of a tree, though, for example, because they very easily may hatch out of that, and then the caterpillars will crawl up and start feeding on the leaves of the tree.
Okay, makes sense. And let's go to the phones. We've got Josh and Mauston with a question for us. Hi, Josh.
Hi.
What's your question?
Well, I've seen those stink bugs, the longer ones, like brown with that tan, I guess, they're camouflage, and they walk really slow on your walls and whatnot, and they have that distinct smell when you try to grab them or even when you do kill them. But I've seen other bugs that have that same color. They're like half as long as a stink bug, but kind of looks like a shield, like when someone holds a shield or the bottom's a U and it's like flat on the top. They have that same design as a stink bug, but they're shorter. And I was just curious if those are like a male or female stink bug or if it's something totally different.
Okay, thanks, Josh. PJ?
Yeah, so really good observation. And what I think you're dealing with in a case like this, it sounds like two different types of insects. And the longer, more slender one, I'd have to see a picture to confirm, but my suspicion is that it's probably an insect called a western conifer seed bug. And these are insects associated with spruce trees and other conifers outdoors. But they have the habit of sneaking indoors in fall when they're looking for a sheltered overwintering spot. Now, these western conifer seed bugs aren't from the stink bug family, but they're from a closely related family, and they do also have a fairly strong odor if you were to disturb them or crush them. So I think that is the first one. That western conifer seed bug would be the one that's a little bit skinnier, more oblong and slender. The ones that are a little bit shorter, maybe around half inch or just over that in length, with that shield-shaped body, those would be your classic stink bugs. And there's a newer species that we have been seeing in the state over the last 10 to 12 years. It's called the brown marmorated stink bug. And this one is notorious for sneaking into structures in the fall. From their point of view, they would want to get into a sheltered spot, hunker down, and then leave again in spring. But sometimes they end up in a wall void or a soffit area in a spot where it's warm enough that they'll become active during the winter months. And so that's why we can see them indoors as well. So I think it sounds like two different things. One is that brown marmorated stink bug, and that skinnier one sounds like the western conifer seed bug.
Okay. I think I had one of those living in my shower not too long ago. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Courtney Everett is our on-air producer today, and Tyler Ditter is our technical director. We're talking about insects with PJ Leash. He is the manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Join in. We've got open lines, 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. And let's go to Anna in Madison. Hi, Anna.
Hi. We have been noticing the bats flying around at night here in Madison. And we're wondering, what are they feeding on? Because there doesn't seem to be very many gnats or mosquitoes or anything around.
PJ?
Yeah, good question. There are actually a few insects that can be active this time of the year. There's not nearly as many, though, as compared to later spring or in the summer months. You're definitely right about that. There's not a whole lot of things right now. Off the top of my head, I can think of quite a few different moth species, though, that overwinter as adults. And as soon as it gets to be warm enough, generally up into maybe the 40s or 50s, for example, some of those insects can become active. And so they may be serving as a food source for them. We also have a number of other insects that sometime, depending on the particular species, they will overwinter as adults. And again, as soon as it's just warm enough for those adults to be active and flying, you can get them moving around, and that may be a food source for the bats. So I can't give you a specific answer in terms of which exact species they're feeding on, but again, there are a number of insects that overwinter as adults, and once it gets just warm enough, they can become active. So I would suspect they're maybe feeding on something like that.
Okay, thank you, Anna. Appreciate the call. Let's go to Louise in Dodgeville next. Hi, Louise. What can we help you with?
Hi. I have a question about rusty patch bumblebees. Where we are in Wisconsin, we have a lot of the native habitat and food sources that they like to, you know, the host plants that they like to feed off of. And a few people have speculated that we might be able to see a rusty patch bumblebee, which is endangered. So I guess I'm wondering how to be a bee watcher. Like, how would we even try to go about, like, watching one or finding one?
Yeah, so good question. And I think it's a fun topic to think about. They are definitely out there. And if you look at the U.S. as a whole, parts of Wisconsin, including the southern half of the state, does seem to be a decent area for them. Just for example, at the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab last summer, I had a week in August where I think I had three different sightings where folks had sent me pictures or video within the span of a week. So they are out there if you have the right habitats for them. One caveat about identifying rusty patch bumblebees is if you're not familiar with them, there are a couple of other bumblebee species that can be pretty common and also have this rusty orange color. And usually folks will see these and think they found a rusty patch, but it's really a different species. So there are things like the red-belted bumblebee and the tricolored bumblebee, for example. And on those, the rusty orangish stripes on the abdomen are really going to be quite noticeable. The thing about the rusty patch bumblebee is on its abdomen, there are two segments that have a yellowish band, and then there's just this kind of hint of rusty orange in the middle of one of those yellowish bands. So my first piece of advice would be to get some resources so that you can have them on hand to be able to tell rusty patch apart from some of the other lookalikes. I know there's some really good resources online. For example, there's a guide to the bumblebees of the eastern United States, which I think is by U.S. Forest Service. I want to say there also are a number of really good resources for Wisconsin. There's a group called the Bumblebee Brigade here in the state. And then also I have some colleagues in the department that if you simply Google search Bumblebees of Wisconsin, you'll be able to find their website, and they have some kind of line drawings to help you be able to identify and differentiate out in your yard or garden if it's a rusty patch versus some of the other species. So that would be my main piece of advice, would simply to be to track down one or more of these resources so that you know exactly what to look for. So when you're out spending time in your yard and garden, you can tell if it's actually rusty patch or something else. If you're not sure and you've got, say, your smartphone with you or a camera, and you're able to get some pictures or a video clip of it, you'd always be welcome to send that in to me, and I can take a peek and let you know if you did indeed spot one or not.
Okay, thank you for that call, Louise. We've got open lines. If you have a question or observation, or maybe you have a picture yourself and you want it ID'd, you can send that to our email, which is ideas@wpr.org, or you can give us a call, 800-642-1234. So, PJ, we've had a lot, you know, we get a lot of people on Wednesday, and we talk about apps for your phone that can help you identify things like birds and flowers and fauna, that kind of a thing. Is there one out there that's particularly good for insects?
Yeah, so one of my favorites is an app called Seek, I believe is the name of it. And
it,
I have it
is.
On
I'm looking at
phone.
It right now on my phone, too.
Yeah, so I use that one quite a bit. It is decent for insects. Now, also, you have to keep in mind that a lot of insects are pretty darn small compared to birds and other things like that. And so when you use an app like Seek, what it does is it uses the AI algorithms, and it gives you its best estimate of what an insect is. And in some cases, it may only be able to tell you this is an insect or it's a beetle, and it just can't identify it any further from that. So an app like Seek does have its limitations, but personally and as a professional entomologist, I use it quite a bit. I think it's really pretty fun to go out in your yard or if you're hiking in a park and stuff like that, and you can pull it out and identify plants and insects and other things relatively quickly. For really small things, again, I sometimes don't trust it as much, or again, it won't be able to tell you the exact species. So there are limitations to it. It seems to work best for insects that are larger, and especially things that almost have more of a two-dimensional aspect to them. So if you think about moths and butterflies, especially if they have landed, the way their wings are, they're so large and flat, it's almost 2D if you think about it. So the app seems to work very well for those, but definitely worth the time because it's a free app to track that one down. And that's often one that I suggest to folks. Again, you just have to understand the limitations of it. And sometimes it won't be able to give you that exact species, but it'll start to narrow it down to maybe order or family level.
I agree. I was wondering if there was one more that was a little bit better for insects because I've had the same problem with it. But overall, it's a wonderful app. And I mean, I recommend it for families, especially go out with your kids, give them the app on the phone and let them figure out what everything is. Such fun. Such fun. Let's go back to the phones. And we've got Carol in New Richmond. Hi, Carol. What can we help you with?
Hi there. I'm just wondering, is there a solution to the invasion of box elder bugs in your home coming in from the outside? We tried to seal up everything, and I don't really want to resort to chemicals, but wondered if there was a natural way to get rid of them.
Yeah, a good question. As you mentioned, the idea of sealing things up, that can go a long ways. However, box elder bugs aren't that big. So sometimes it just isn't all that feasible to completely seal everything up. But the more sealing that you can do, the better. And in the pest control industry, we would refer to that as physical exclusion. And again, that's sealing up the nooks and crannies and cracks and crevices. If the insects can't get in to begin with, then they're not going to be a problem this time of the year. So that is often one of the best and most important steps. However, if you just have a house where the siding or other features of the house make it hard to seal things up, maybe you're in an old farmhouse or something like that, then the alternative approach would be to use an insecticide. However, if you are concerned about harming other insects and things like that, one thing to keep in mind is that with these types of products, we're really only applying a small strip to cracks and crevices where we think the box elder bugs may be getting in. So I would focus primarily on, for example, the southern and western faces of your home where it gets the afternoon sun and warms up. That's often where box elder bugs like to go. So we can use that in combination. But again, we're not spraying the entire sides of the house, anything like that. We're just doing a little strip along those spots we think they're getting in. A conventional product will generally offer protection for several weeks at a time. If you really don't want to go that route, one option that is kind of more natural or more green, if you want to try it, would be to spray the box elder bugs directly with like a soapy water solution. You have to understand the limitations, though. So if you see a group of, say, 50 box elder bugs on the side of your house, you can spray them with soapy water, and that should control those. But the soapy water is only going to work on the insects that are directly sprayed with that soapy water solution. And once it's dried, it's done working. So if it is, say, a hot, like 75-degree day in early October, and you're seeing lots of box elder bug activity, we may spray soapy water on them, but it could be dry 15 minutes later and it's done working, and more could show up after that. So you really have to understand the limitations of some of those kind of home remedy type treatments.
Thank you, Carol. Appreciate that call. We've had callers before that have mentioned that they just take their vacuum cleaner and vacuum them up. Is that a good way to get rid of those in the house?
Yeah, that is. And I didn't have a chance to mention that yet. Once they get indoors into your home, at that point, we've kind of lost the battle because they made it in. And so once insects like box elder bugs or stink bugs, or there's western conifer seed bugs, get indoors, that's usually my top recommendation, is to get out the vacuum cleaner, use that hose attachment to suck them up. In a lot of cases, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to spray anything indoors. From the point of view of the insects, if they are indoors and active during the winter months, it's not a good thing for them because they are losing moisture to the air. They don't have food sources and stuff like that. And so from their point of view, they're going to be burning through their energy reserves. They really don't want to be doing that. So they're not going to be thriving indoors. They're just kind of trying to hang on. And so, again, spraying really is pretty overkill indoors. I prefer going with the hose attachment on the vacuum cleaner.
Okay. And up next, Paul in Milwaukee has a question. Hi, Paul.
Yes, I was wondering about, I think they're called velvet mites, these tiny little, they're almost, you can barely see them, real bright orange. I'm wondering if they're related to chiggers, if they're any danger to humans, what they feed on, and why they seem to gravitate to sunny surfaces where there's nothing for them to eat.
Yeah, so these velvet mites, if you have not bumped into them before, they are these small reddish mites, although some of them can be relatively large as far as mites go. They're very, very common. Just about any time you go outdoors, you'll see them kind of wandering on sunny rocks and things like that. They are indeed related to chiggers, but velvet mites really aren't any concern for humans. They're mostly just a curiosity in my mind. The juvenile stages tend to parasitize other arthropods, so either insects or arachnids and things like that. But the adults can actually be beneficial predators of things like insect eggs. So they might help us out in that regard. Velvet mites in general, they don't like to come indoors. So I think of them, again, just as kind of an outdoor curiosity. If they were to accidentally wander indoors, it'd be a wrong turn for them. They just would not fare well in the dry conditions inside. So, again, I think of them mostly as a curiosity. No real need for concern with those if you're seeing them in your yard or on the side of your house or anything like that.
Okay, thank you, Paul, for that call. And if you have a question, give us a call, too, 800-642-1234. Barbara in Germantown, what can we help you with today?
Well, I used to respond to tornadoes and hurricanes, and one response was in St. Thomas. One of my coworkers had stuck her hand into a crevice and was bit by a spider. It became very bad, and she went to our firm's health services, who told her it was okay. Several days later, she showed it to me, and there was necrosis around the swelling. And I sent her to the military field hospital. There they had to debride the wound, and she was put on medication. My question is, what kind of spider could that have been, and would it be here in the U.S.? And no, I did not escape either. I got dengue fever. But I'm over it.
Okay, well, good to hear that. Any idea? I know that there's a lot of spiders in the world, PJ.
Yeah, well, and it's always hard to tell in a case like this. When it comes to spider bites in general, if you look at Wisconsin or the Midwest, for example, here in the state, we've got about 500 or so species of spiders, and pretty much all of those are essentially harmless to humans. We have one species native to our area, the northern black widow, which is medically relevant, but bites seem to be exceedingly rare. However, you know, spider bites, they could occur if you are reaching into something and there's a spider there and maybe you're squishing it and it bites defensively. But unless you collect the spider and get it properly identified, it's always hard to tell exactly what it was. There is one species of spider, the brown recluse, which is generally pretty notorious in terms of what folks seem to know about it. That species can be associated with necrotic wounds in some cases. It doesn't occur on Caribbean islands or anything like that, though. That species is really restricted to the south central portion of the U.S. states like Oklahoma and Kansas, Nebraska. It does get up towards Missouri, but that's outside of our range here in Wisconsin. And another complicating factor is that sometimes there are other things that can cause what to a doctor may resemble a spider bite. And so it's always hard, unless you saw the spider bite you and know for sure it was a spider bite, it's possible in some situations that there might be other medical explanations. There are some times documented in the literature where what was assumed to initially be a spider bite ended up being some sort of bacterial or microbial infection, and that would need to be handled differently than a spider bite. So again, I can't really give you a good answer at this point, because unless we saw the spider and caught it and got it identified, it'd be hard to tell. But also, if a spider was not directly observed biting, it's also possible there may be other explanations for that necrotic type wound.
Thank you very much, Barbara. We have an email that's kind of similar to that. Jan in Barnes called. She says she was bitten multiple times by a small tan spider. It happened while she was outside wearing long sleeves, and she ended up in the hospital the next day with a fever of 105, other symptoms. She had sepsis, and her insurance company says that these bites have happened to others. She wants to know what is the spider, and considering that poisonous spiders supposedly don't live in Wisconsin.
Yeah, so this one, I mean, definitely a similar theme to the last question. And again, without seeing the spider and really getting it under the microscope, I can't give you a good idea of what the spider would be. Again, brown recluse spiders, their range is to the south of us, places like Missouri, Nebraska, Oklahoma. Also, it turns out that brown recluse spiders very rarely bite people. They really have no reason to bite people. And so something like that would be very, very unlikely in a situation like this, given our northern location. All of our other spiders that we have here in Wisconsin, though, for the most part, are going to be relatively harmless. They do technically have venom, but it isn't very potent from a human health standpoint. So one possibility would be that if spider bites occurred, it isn't necessarily that the spider venom is potent, but it may be the individual's reaction to it, how their immune system reacts to it, that sometimes might lead to some more, you know, severe symptoms. So I really can't rule that out either. But again, without seeing the spider and really getting under the microscope, can't tell you what it is. But in general, I really don't think of spiders in Wisconsin here being medically relevant, other than the northern black widow, which is really restricted to some very specific habitats in parts of the state.
Okay. And Betty from Dodgeville called with a question. Would diatomaceous earth work to protect yourself from chiggers or get rid of them?
Yeah. So diatomaceous earth, you can certainly run out to the hardware store or garden center and get it. In my mind, it isn't a particularly good product to use for many things at all. There are certain types of diatomaceous earth that can work very well in specific situations. So, for example, diatomaceous earth, insecticide-grade products can be used successfully indoors to control things such as bed bugs. But if you think about the indoor habitat, it's dry for the most part. And so the diatomaceous earth can work well in those types of settings. Outdoors, it doesn't seem to work well, if at all, just due to moisture, humidity, dew and rain and stuff like that. So in terms of dealing with chiggers, it would not be a good option for that. It probably wouldn't help whatsoever. When I think of chiggers, if you do find yourself in a situation where you know you have them in your yard or a nearby park that you visit, that sort of thing, my emphasis would really be on personal protection, wearing long sleeves, using repellents like DEET and things like that. Also, if you know that you're going to an area that you've historically bumped into chiggers, When you are done with that, doing things like changing out of that set of clothes into a different set can be helpful, as well as coming home and taking a hot shower relatively soon thereafter, so that if there are any on you, you can wash them off. Those are generally going to be some of the more effective approaches for dealing with chiggers.
Okay, let's go back to the phone. And if you have a call or you have a question, give us a call, 800-642-1234. And next we have Andy in Mount Horeb. Hi, Andy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I went out for a ride on, I live in Mount Horeb, and I went out for a ride on Sunday. And I was checking some of the trout streams to see if any bugs were hatching. And I went over to Mount Vernon, and there was a big mating swarm of midges, and they were really, really tiny. I've never seen any quite that small before.
Did you have a specific question, Andy, or are you just giving us a report?
Just a report.
Okay, sounds good. PJ, have you heard that too?
You know, I haven't heard any specific reports like that. However, I'm familiar myself with the streams down by like Mount Vernon area and stuff like that. It really doesn't surprise me. Again, we have had some warmer temperatures recently. We've also had just in the last two or so weeks here in southern Wisconsin, some rain, some warmer temperatures to melt snow. And so that can kind of get things moving in streams and stuff like that. But yeah, it doesn't really surprise me at all, especially for insects that are aquatic. They develop in or close to water during their juvenile stages. Those insects are going to be pretty well adapted to cold water conditions during the winter months. And so we just get a little bit of warmth and things can start popping out. Any good fly fisherman would know throughout the season, there's going to be this progression of a number of different insects that pop out at different times of the year. So sounds like you've already seen a bit of activity out there, and I'm expecting things to pick up even more with some of the temperatures we're having just this week alone.
Yeah, for sure. I've been checking that out. It looks very warm. So thanks for the report, Andy. We appreciate that. And we're talking about insects on the show today with PJ Leash. He is the manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. What questions are on your mind? Have you seen an unusual insect? Do you have questions about something that's been bothering you? Well, give us a call at 800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. On the show tomorrow, we'll celebrate St. Patrick's Day by talking about the Celtic wisdom of trees and one woman's mission to save them and combat climate change. And we'll also take a look at the Irish in Wisconsin. That's tomorrow, Thursday, starting at 11 on the Ideas Network. Right now, we're talking about insects, and we'll go straight back to the phone. Ben in Green Bay, what's your question?
Hello. Hi, I had a question, interesting one. I raise reptiles, and for them, I raise dubia roaches, which are in the same family as Madagascar hissing cockroaches. But the colony of roaches is growing much faster than my lizards can eat them, and I was wondering if you had any tips on how I can maybe trim that back or cull them. So far, I haven't thought of an efficient way of doing so.
Oh, that is an interesting question. I bet you don't get too many of those, PJ.
Well, interestingly, so I actually have in the back room of my lab, I have some colonies of Madagascar hissing roaches, peppered roaches, and I do have a small colony of these dubia roaches. So I have worked with them a bit. A question for you, Ben, do you have any sort of like heating pad on? Do you have them in like an aquarium tank with a heating pad, something like that?
I do have it's basically a seedling heating pad.
Okay.
Although, however, they seem to breed without it as well.
Okay. I mean, one general thought, because I do this with my colonies of Madagascar hissing roaches and the peppered roaches, because those I have in big aquarium tanks. If I have the colonies and they start getting to be too big, there's too many of them, I will unplug the heating pads. Simply because they are, you know, in essence, cold-blooded creatures. So the warmer they are, their physiology and life cycle can go about things faster. And if they are cooler, that's going to slow them down. So my general suggestion would be to figure out a way to slow them down. if you have them in, say, the same room as reptile tanks and things like that, and the room is relatively warm for sake of the reptiles, one consideration may be to move the roaches to another location where you can keep them cooler. And so if your room with the reptiles or where the roaches are is, say, 72, if you can get them to a spot where maybe it's 65, such as a basement or something like that, that should slow them down. That's probably going to be your easiest way to go about doing that. Otherwise, one consideration, if you simply have way too many of them, you could, if you know someone else with reptiles or birds, give them some. Otherwise, you could just kind of cull the herd. Go in and pull some of them out, put them in a bag, and you could always freeze that to euthanize them and kind of slim down your colony that way. That would be another consideration. But I'd probably try cooling them down first and foremost.
Okay, good luck, Ben. Let us know how that works. That's an interesting question. Next up is Jason in Cudahy. Hi, Jason.
Hey, how are you doing?
Great. What can we help you with?
I do a lot of hiking, and I know when it, you know, starts getting warm out, start having issues with ticks, and I'm just wondering if you have any tips to get rid of the ticks. Keep them away.
Sure. Yeah, and this definitely is a very timely topic, especially with the warm temperatures that a lot of parts of the state are seeing. And I like to remind folks that ticks can be active essentially year-round. You can even find them sometimes on the snow during the winter months. They wouldn't be very active at that point. They'd be pretty lethargic if it's cool temperatures. But if it's above freezing, you could potentially bump into ticks out there. So I know a lot of folks are probably getting out and walking and hiking this week with our temperatures, and so that's really a good topic that we're talking about right now. Some of my general precautions, first and foremost, personal protection. So that is things like wearing long sleeve, especially pants, and sometimes tucking your pants into your socks can be a good precaution. That just makes a more contiguous barrier, so it's harder for those ticks to get to your skin. And in general, ticks are coming from ground level up. They're not able to jump down out of trees, things like that. They just don't have that aspect in their behavior. So they're really wandering up from lower legs and things like that. So we can, again, use long pants. Tuck your pants into socks would be an extra layer of protection. Using repellents like DEET. If you're not a fan of DEET for whatever reason, there are some other effective ones out there, like Picaridin is another one. The EPA actually has a really good tool online. If you simply did a Google search for like EPA tick and mosquito repellent tool, you should be able to find it. And you can search through all these different ingredients, and it'll tell you how long they will work for and that sort of thing. So you can find them that you can use. But make sure you are using those repellents, applying them correctly. Some say apply to clothing. Some say apply to skin or vice versa. So make sure you're following those directions. It'll also tell you how long you should go before reapplying it and that sort of thing. So use those repellents. If you spend a lot of time outdoors, it may be worth it to use a longer-lasting repellent-type product. Now, you can go to sporting goods stores and get products that contain the ingredient permethrin. I have seen these from a number of brands, from 3M and Sawyer and things like that. You can find them at Gander and Fleet Farm and REI and places like that. What's nice about the permethrin products is they last for quite a while on clothing. They can often last through several washings. And this isn't something you stand there and spritz it on yourself. You actually treat your clothes. You lie them out and treat them ahead of time. You could do like a pair of hiking pants, a pair of hiking boots, and things like that. And again, the permethrin products offer some long-term protection, and the permethrin itself does two different things. The first is it irritates and repels the ticks. So if they do get on you because you brushed against some vegetation, the ticks don't like it, and they will drop off. So that accomplishes the goal of getting ticks off you. But if they contact the permethrin long enough, it actually has insecticidal or really acaricidal properties, meaning it will kill those ticks in addition. So I'm a big fan of that. Some other general tips, if you have a dog or an outdoor cat, make sure that you are giving those animals the preventative treatments that they need for fleas and ticks and other things. So make sure you're chatting with your veterinarian about that. And then lastly, if you have concerns in your yard, maybe you back up to a wooded area or things like that, there are some tips you can do in your yard. You can keep the lawn mowed relatively low. Ticks need moisture, and so if your yard is open and sunny and drier, it's not going to be good tick habitat. Sometimes folks will use a turf grass insecticide and treat the edge of their lawn where it meets, say, a wooded area. That way, if ticks are moving into a lawn from those areas, you can stop them in their tracks there. And there are also some devices out there called tick tubes, which you can purchase. And these are little cardboard tubes filled with cotton that has been treated with permethrin, that same repellent ingredient I mentioned earlier. And you put these out in areas in your yard where mice may be living. The idea is that the mice go and collect this cotton. They take it back for nesting purposes, and they brush up against it. So the mice basically get treated with permethrin, and if the ticks try to get on them, it's hopefully going to kill the ticks as well. So those are some things that you can do both on yourself but in your yard to help deal with ticks this spring and summer.
Awesome advice, PJ. Thank you. And thank you for the question, Jason. And I think if you just Google those little tick tubes, you can get instructions on how to make them yourself too, right?
There are instructions I've seen online. However, it's kind of this gray area because if you look at the pesticide labels, and if you buy a pesticide product, the instructions on there have to be approved by the federal EPA. And unless it says on the label you can specifically spray cotton balls to make your own tick tubes, if it doesn't say that, you legally can't. So, again, it is this gray area. And to date, and I've brought in some colleagues that work with ticks, and we've had conversations with other groups as well, we don't know of any products where it legally says you can do that. So, again, that's kind of a word of advice is that it's technically not allowed. So you have to hop online and purchase the pre-made tick tubes.
Okay. Thank you, PJ. Let's go to Rowley in Oak Creek. Hi, Rowley. What can we help you with?
Hi, PJ. Thanks for taking my call. As we know, the climate's changing, and I'm curious how that's going to affect our beneficial insects that we have here, as well as prowl insects that might come along because of the climate change. Thanks a lot. That's my question.
Sure. Well, Rowley, thanks for that question. I mean, that is certainly a big topic that we could talk about for quite a while. When it comes to things such as climate change, but also just changes in general due to urbanization and deforestation and things like that, there's a lot of things that are impacting insects right now. And we do hear more and more about insect declines in general. One important theme that kind of stands out with all these changes is that insects are going to respond differently. Essentially, there will be some winners that maybe do better. There's going to be some losers that don't do as well, and they may even die out and go extinct potentially. And we don't know the exact way that it's going to go for each species out there. So it is hard to tell. Just some general thoughts, though. With climate change, that is probably going to extend our growing season. Essentially, we're going to have earlier springs and later fall. That is going to increase the time span where insects can be active. That may allow pests, for example, to potentially squeeze in an extra generation or sometimes more than that. It's going to depend, again, on the individual insect species. But we could see that happening, and that could pose problems for agriculture, but also even just home garden settings, for example. So we may see some increases in pests like that. I would expect increases in pests that are, or insects in general, that are very adaptable and maybe have a broad range and can tolerate a wider range of habits and temperatures and things like that, versus if we have insects that are restricted to very specific habitat types, those are more likely going to be disrupted by climate change. And earlier on the show today, we talked about the rusty patch bumblebee, which I said we do have some sightings around here in southern Wisconsin. but they're restricted to very specific habitat types. And so if things warm up a lot, those insects might need to push farther north to meet areas where the temperatures are right for them. But if they don't have the right habitat in terms of plants and things like that, they won't be able to survive. So that's a concern in my mind, is insects that are associated with very, very specific habitats, it may be hard for them to be able to shift versus insects that are adapted to a wider range of habitats. So again, it's a very, very big topic. We're certainly going to see some insects maybe doing better with warmer climates, but some insects, unfortunately, are going to be harmed by the same conditions.
Okay, thank you for bringing that topic up. And as you could tell, we're talking about insects today with PJ Leash, and we do have a couple of lines filled, but we also have a couple open. So give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org, and we have a number of those that we will get to when we get back from this break for the news. So stay with us. We'll be back in just a bit. It's time to talk about insects on the show today. And of course, we'd like to hear from you. Give us a call, 800-642-1234. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. I'm Jill Nadeau. And PJ Leash is back with us. He's the manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. And let's go right back to the phones, PJ. We have Bob in Cedarburg with a question. Hi, Bob.
Hi, how are you?
Well, thanks. What can we help you with today?
Well, we're considering getting or making a bee house to try and attract bees in our backyard. I guess you can get them at Stein's, but I guess you can make them yourself. And you fill them with leaves or wood, and you put holes in them and you try and attract the bees. But how does a bee house attract the bees and not wasps? We're not big fans of the wasps.
Great question, Bob. PJ, is there a magic that goes along with these bee houses?
Well, it turns out, so if you have these bee houses, yes, they can attract certain types of bees. They can also attract wasps, though. However, the wasps that they might attract really aren't a concern for you. These are not types of wasps that will sting. It turns out, when I say the word wasp, a lot of times folks think of, you know, black and yellow things that live together as a colony and are going to sting you when you're mowing the lawn or something like that. These are not those types of wasps. The wasps that would be drawn to the same types of bee houses actually have similar biology to the bees in that they are solitary nesters. And so essentially what these bee houses do is they put out a series of small tubes, because many of our solitary bees and some of these wasps like to nest in pre-existing tubes. Now, out in nature, that might be a hollow plant stem, or they may excavate kind of the pithy center of like a pruned stem on a rose bush or something like that. And so inside you have these little tunnels. And then what they do is they go in, they are provisioning these little compartments or cells with food for their young. So the bees are going to stash away pollen and nectar. The wasps that have the same habit are going to be stashing insect prey that their young will feed on. So really, in my mind, you don't have to be worried about these types of wasps. They're simply using the same type of resources and habitat. Now, in terms of actually making these nests, there are a couple ways to go about this. As you mentioned, Bob, you can go to Stein's Garden Center or other places, and you can go online too, and you can purchase some. That's one route to go. Or you can make your own. One general piece of advice, this is simply a suggestion. Some of the bee houses that you can buy use tubes that are basically cut pieces of bamboo. And one possible concern with that is if the same bee house is used multiple years in a row, there's the possibility that if there were the buildup of a pathogen, a disease that was impacting those insects, well, if that same bee house is used again next year, you could have that disease carry over and affect this year's bees. Versus you can actually buy kits where you can replace each year the tubes, which are these cardboard or cardstock tubes. And so I'm a fan of that just because we can help prevent any disease or parasite issues that might build up over time. So in my own yard, for example, I built a little bee house, and I can just slide in a set of these cardboard tubes every year, and that way they have a fresh nesting material to work with. So those are my general suggestions for making your own bee house if you're interested in that.
Great. Thank you so much, Bob, for that question. PJ, just to remind people that, you know, wasps have good, they do good things too, don't they? We shouldn't be afraid of them, unless you're allergic, of course. But
right. Well, and, I mean, as I mentioned, Jill, when I say the word wasp, folks often think of things like paper wasps and yellow jackets and bald-faced hornets. Those are really, in my mind, kind of an oddity in that they are social wasps. We have dozens of families of wasps out there in the state, and most of them either would go unrecognized by most folks, or they are noticeable in terms of their size, but they're completely harmless to us. We have plenty of wasps that really can't sting you even if they wanted to. Many of our tiny wasps are what we would call parasitoids. So a good parasite doesn't kill its host. A parasitoid does kill its host. So we have plenty of these wasps that will be abundant and present out in your garden, helping control aphids and caterpillars and things like that. We have lots of wasps that hunt spiders. So if you're not a fan of spiders, some wasp species actually help you out in that regard, like our mud daubers would be a good example of that. And we have many, many wasps that are actually pretty good pollinators. And even the ones that can sting, like those paper wasps and yellow jackets and bald-faced hornets, you know, if you've got that nest right outside your front door, that's going to be a concern. If that nest is way in the back corner of your yard and you don't really go back there, you don't have to worry about them. And those wasps are actually really good predators. They can come into your garden and take pest caterpillars off of your crops and stuff like that. And so there's really a lot of benefits that we get from wasps out there in our yard and gardens and in the greater landscape around us.
Great. Thank you so much. A good thing to remember about all the insects. Think about what they help, too. Let's go to David in Wanakee. Hi, David.
Good afternoon. I have an invasion of a small bug that looks like a fruit fly. I've looked this up online, and apparently it's not a fruit fly. It's some fly the size of that. But it has to do with overwatering of plants. It's a fungus-based bug. And I don't know how to get rid of it. All of my plants have turned into desert creatures now. So what do I do?
Sure. So it sounds like you've bumped into insects that I would call a fungus gnat. And if you aren't 100% certain, David, you're always welcome to take some pictures of them and email those to me, or you could even collect a few. And you mentioned you're in Wanakee, which isn't terribly far away from UW-Madison campus where I work. You could always bring a couple in. That way we can just be 100% certain that they are indeed fungus gnats. As you alluded to, though, fungus gnats can very often be associated with houseplants, especially houseplants that are overwatered. And keep in mind, during the winter months, especially, indoor plants don't need a whole lot of water because they're not really actively growing all that much. The lighting isn't good, temperature isn't good, and so forth. So often my first suggestion to folks is decrease watering if you have fungus gnat problems. The second thing you can do, you can go to the hardware store or gardening center. You can purchase what are called sticky card traps. They look like an index card, but they're often a bright, vibrant yellow color, and they're covered both sides with sticky glue, and they usually come with stakes. You can actually put these into the potted plants. The adult fungus gnats can be attracted to that, and if they touch it, they get stuck. So that can be helpful, first as a control tool, because if they get stuck to it, you're taking them out of the equation, but also for monitoring purposes, especially if you swap out the sticky card traps over time, you may notice that, okay, this month on the traps we caught 100 fungus gnats. Well, next month, if we only catch 10, we can then plot that trajectory and know how things are going. So they're also a useful monitoring tool. One other option that you could consider if they do seem to be really bad, actually, two final things. So the adults are annoying and they fly around, but it's really the larvae that are keeping the fire going, so to speak. And the larvae are feeding on decomposing plant materials down amongst the soil and potting mix. So good sanitation, cleaning things off the top of the potting mix, fallen leaves and stuff like that, that's getting rid of some of their food source. You could also take cut off a slice of potato and plop it down on the top of the soil or potting mix. If fungus gnats are present in that particular pot, they'll come up within a day or so and start to feed on the starches. And so you can sometimes use that trick to figure out, is it certain pots that are really the problem and other pots not having so many fungus gnats? And then one final thing is there is a pesticide out there. It's actually based on a naturally occurring bacteria called BT or Bacillus thuringiensis. And you can buy this product. They come as either a granular pellet. Sometimes larger ones are sold as these little briquettes we can use for controlling mosquito larvae and things like that. But I'm trying to recall the name of the product off the top of my head. I know the one for mosquitoes is Mosquito Dunks. But I've seen it at Menards and other hardware stores. And this granular product, you can apply to the surface of the soil. You have to water it in then, and this bacterial material gets into the soil. If the larvae ingest it, it kills them. And so that can be a kind of reduced risk or kind of greener option for directly targeting the larvae or the fungus gnats. So between all those approaches, you should be able to take care of the issue if they are indeed true fungus gnats. But as I mentioned, my first approach is generally cut back on watering. That seems to really help in a lot of cases.
Great. Thanks for that potato trick, PJ. I hadn't heard that one before. I like that. Next up is Roy in Whitewater. Excuse me. Hi, Roy.
Hi there. I have a small choose and cut Christmas tree farm in Whitewater, and the USDA inspector came out last fall to check the condition of my evergreens, but bore the bad news that I have a hot spot of, I guess can't call them gypsy moths anymore, spongy moths or something. Is there anything I can do to preserve this 40 acres? I have a lot of deciduous trees, and I guess they'll eat anything. I've read up about dormant spraying, dormant oil spraying of the egg masses, and trapping the caterpillars as they ascend the trees that they're going to devour. Is it practical for me to go to these efforts, and when should I do it, especially the spraying of the egg masses?
Yeah, good question. The big caveat in a situation like this, it sounds like you have a pretty good area you're trying to protect, and that is really going to complicate things, because even if you go out and you spray individual egg masses and things like that, you may be taking care of those, but for every egg mass you miss, that could turn into 500 to 1,000 caterpillars. And so even if you get 50% of them, if you have a lot of egg masses around, you could still have quite a few caterpillars out there this spring. So a couple of thoughts. One thing that will really help us out, ask for rain, pray for rain, because if we have a rainy spring, that actually helps us out quite a bit with gypsy moth. The reason for that is there is an introduced disease, Entomophaga myemiga, that gypsy moth actually comes down sick with if it's a rainy spring, or even if it's about average precipitation, it usually kicks in. Last year, we didn't see it work because it was so darn dry. So if we have a rainy spring, that should help us out. And sometimes that disease just kicks in and can cause really high mortality, like 75%+ mortality in a short period of time. So hope for some rain this year. That'll help us out. Some other thoughts, and I mentioned this on the air earlier today, but the egg masses are out there now. They actually spend about 3/4 of their entire lifespan as egg masses. So those egg masses sit from like last July until they hatch in about April of this year. So you still have about a good month or so where we may be able to go out and do something about the egg masses. So you could scrape those off with a putty knife. You could spray them with a dormant oil, or you could spray them with a conventional insecticide product, and that should help control them as well. Some other options, which you mentioned, you can use burlap bands. This would be to capture the caterpillars. And actually, there's two types of bands. We can do a sticky band, and we can do a burlap band. The sticky band would be relatively early in the caterpillar stage, so probably like late April or so. This is when we have young, small caterpillars that are wandering around. You have to wrap the tree with saran wrap, and then we can put sticky like Vaseline or Tanglefoot on it. And if the caterpillars touch it, they get stuck. So that can be one option. When the caterpillars get bigger, they become very much nocturnally active. And so they want to hide out during the day. So they'll actually climb up the tree to go feed in the evening and go down the tree and hide during the day. And so we can put a piece of twine or string around a tree trunk, like an oak, drape a bit of burlap over it. And then you'd have to go out every single day during like the noon hour or something like that and bring a bucket of soapy water, some other ways of disposing for them, and knock those caterpillars in there. So that's an option. But for large areas, it can be very time-consuming because you would have to go out there and check those burlap bands every single day. Otherwise, for wooded areas, if you're trying to protect a large wooded area, then to really accomplish that and maximize protection, you'd be talking about like aerial applications. And in some parts of the state, that is done to help control this spongy moth, or again, it was formerly known as the gypsy moth. But sometimes like neighborhoods or municipalities have to band together and hire an aerial applicator to make a treatment to control these in some cases.
Okay, good luck, Roy. That's not a fun thing to have to face. Speaking about caterpillars, Frank from Wauwatosa called wondering about tent caterpillars. He's been told to cut the branches off the trees and then to burn them. What do you know about tent caterpillars and how to take care of those, PJ?
Sure. So we actually have quite a few insects that are referred to as tent caterpillars. The commonest one, which I'll mention first, is the eastern tent caterpillar, which we see in the spring, and they are fairly specific in what they feed on. They like to feed on things such as crab apples and cherries, and sometimes they get into fruit trees as well, but they don't go to most other hardwood trees, or very rarely. So that's an insect where you can literally identify it driving down the highway because you'll see it on like black cherry trees in the woods. For something like that, there's really no need to cut out or prune out that part of the tree. The insects themselves, even if they, say, defoliated an entire young crab apple or something like that, the tree's probably going to leaf out fine again. I'd be nervous if it happens year after year. But one simple option, rather than pruning out that net, you could go in there and if it makes you squeamish, you know, put on a pair of gardening gloves. But you could simply rip out the net. You could squish caterpillars that are present hiding inside the net. Or you could even take like some soapy water and give that silken webbing, that netting or tent, a really good soaking. And that would be a way to deal with it. But again, there's really no need to prune out it and burn anything. I have heard that kind of, perspective. It almost seems to be like an urban myth that you need to prune these out and burn them, but you really don't need to. A second species of tent caterpillar, the forest tent caterpillar, also occurs in the spring. And it's a close relative of the eastern tent caterpillar, but it doesn't make tents. So folks often aren't quite aware of that one. One other species that often gets referred to as a tent caterpillar occurs from like midsummer onwards, from about mid to late July onwards, and that is called the fall webworm. And that one tends to make silken tents out towards the tips of branches more. But same kind of approach with the eastern caterpillar in spring. We really don't need to prune it out. There, you know, in terms of control standpoint, there's not necessarily a need for that. If you're doing pruning anyways, then I guess you could get two birds with one stone. Otherwise, it's often reasonable just to directly treat that tent itself, and that will take care of the issue.
Okay, thank you very much, PJ. Let's go to Chris in Adams. Hi, Chris.
Good morning. I was sitting outside in the glorious sunshine yesterday, and a bee buzzed by me. And I just wanted to remind people that they should wait until the ambient outside temperature at night is 55 degrees or more before cleaning up their gardens and raking their leaves, because the pollinators hide in that debris when it's cold outside.
Yes, thank you so much, Chris, for that reminder. Right, PJ?
Yeah, and that is a good point. So we have certain bees, like some of our bumblebees, for example, that will overwinter as fertilized queens. And as soon as it warms up enough, you know, maybe if they're on the south side of your house, in amongst mulch or leaf litter in a garden bed, they can become active in March, maybe even February if it's warm enough. So, again, that's a good point about garden cleanup. Sometimes there are bees and other beneficial insects that may be utilizing the plant stems, the fallen leaves, and things like that in our garden. So the longer you can wait, it gives those insects an opportunity to come out, because they're going to leave that area and then hopefully go elsewhere.
Okay, thanks again, Chris, for that reminder. I believe you've got a picture from Noreen in Mondovi, PJ. It looks like a type of bee sucking nectar from a flower. It has orange line across its back. Can you tell her what kind of insect that is?
Sure. So, Noreen, the picture that you sent in, this is a fairly common species. It's called the tri-colored bumblebee, because we have black, yellow, and also this distinctive orange or rusty band. And I actually mentioned this one earlier today, because sometimes folks see that and they see the rusty orange and they assume, oh, it's rusty patch bumblebee, but it's not. The rusty patch only has a little bit of rust color. In this case, it's actually two abdominal segments with very distinctive, easy to see, conspicuous orange rusty banding. So that one was the tri-colored bumblebee.
Okay, thanks for sending that in, Noreen. And remind people again, if they have a question or a picture, how do they contact you?
Yeah, so probably the easiest thing to do, if you hop online and just do a Google search for UW Insect Diagnostic Lab. And if you do that, you should be able to find my website, and I've got instructions on there in terms of how you can email me pictures of an insect to get it identified, or in some cases, it can be helpful to get a physical sample so that I can see things under the microscope. That's really helpful for especially small insects, where it's just hard to tell from a picture. And so if you, again, Google search UW Insect Diagnostic Lab, you'll be able to find my site, and I've got all my instructions on there as well. I'm also pretty active on Twitter as a Wisconsin Bug Guy. And so if you find me on Twitter, I have folks send me pictures on there too. And I can often identify insects from some good digital images. So those would be two ways to get a hold of me.
Excellent. So, and it would be just fun to follow you just to see what other people are finding too.
Oh, definitely.
Okay. Well, we've been talking with PJ Leash today, and PJ, thank you so much for all the information you've given us today, and we'll see you fairly soon, I think.
Yeah, sounds good. Thanks for having me today, Jill.
You bet. That was the PJ Leash. Again, he's the manager of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. And join us again tomorrow when we talk about the Celtic wisdom of trees and look at the history of the Irish in Wisconsin, all getting ready for St. Patrick's Day, which is tomorrow already. I'm Jill Nadeau. I'm in for Larry Mueller this week. Thanks so much for listening to the Ideas Network. Stay well. Thank you.